On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food.
It's very pure, the flavor. Have you ever had veal brains?
I don't know that I've had veal brains, but they must be extremely tender.
They're very tender, and the taste is very pure and soft, so it really requires delicate things with it.
That's Chef Tatiana Levha. A couple of years ago, when she was in her late 20s, Tatiana opened a bistro in Paris with her sister Katia. Now Le Servin is among the most popular restaurants in the city. Hi, Tatiana.
Hi.
We're so happy to have you here.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Could you give us a feel for the neighborhood that Le Servin is in?
It's in the 11th near Père Lachaise. It's a wonderful neighborhood. I've lived in it for more than 10 years now. And it's an arrondissement where lots of restaurants open, young chefs. I think mainly because it's the rent is still quite affordable, and yet it's still a bit quite central enough for people to go there from anywhere in Paris. Yeah,
your menu changes daily, but if you could give us a feel for your food by describing a dish that maybe reappears in different forms often on the menu.
The menu changes daily, but there are things that stay on the menu. We do veal brains, which is really something I think maybe people wouldn't eat here. But people in France who used to eat it when they were young love it. So we have a hard time not cooking brains anymore. So it's just a peeled fresh veal brain that we poach à la minute. And that we serve with butter and lemon and sorrel leaves.
So simple.
Yeah, very simple. Before the entrees, something that we call zakouskis, or like little plates, sharing plates, for people to have while they have a drink before they start their actual meal. And among those plates, we do a black boudin wonton, which is like a fried ravioli. Something people love. It's both very French and very Asian. It's served with a sweet chili sauce. It's something that we love because it's fried. We love everything that's fried and very spicy. And it's a good way to start your meal at the Servant, I think.
How long did you work for others in other kitchens before you opened your own restaurant?
Actually, not that long. I started cooking when I was 21. So I went to school for a while, and then I worked for maybe 5 years for other people, 5 or 6 years, yeah.
And who were those other people?
Mainly Pascal Barbeau from L'Astrance and Alain Passard from L'Arpège.
You're not only French, you're also Filipina.
Yeah, my mom.
What's fascinating to me reading reviews of your restaurant is how shocking it still is to the French dining public to have a mixture of spices and forward flavors.
Yeah, it's true. Fusion food in France, I don't really like that term. But
I don't either.
Right, but people know what it is. So fusion food in France had for a very long time a very bad reputation. Was like very cliche things with very strong flavors, and so people just put it aside for a while, and now spices are coming back, chili's coming back, and it's true that people are a bit surprised, yet they realize that they like it. I mean, it's also in their culture somewhere, so yeah, they just rediscover it in some way.
So this word fusion, that nobody who cooks likes this word. And most critics, I think, who are really on top of things don't like it either. So how do you describe what it is that you do?
Oh, that's a very hard question. My sister does that way better than me, describing what we do. I'd say it's French cuisine with an Asian twist. It's French technique and French produce, but with an Asian influence. or maybe just lots of herbs and acidity and chili.
acidity is interesting. It seems these days, more than anything, I notice chefs playing with sour.
Anyway, I love sour. Since I was little, I eat lemon and salt like that. I love tartness, yeah.
Some of your favorite ways of introducing sour besides vinegar and lemon?
Sorrel. I love sorrel. Yeah, I think it's one of the most interesting sources of sourness. And fruits, rhubarb, sorrel, which isn't a fruit, a leaf, but things like that I think are very interesting.
I understand that you don't drive.
No, no, I don't.
And that you go and you pick up your groceries on a scooter.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I'm thinking of passing my driving license, though.
You can't fit enough things on the scooter.
Yeah, it's becoming ridiculous.
What's it like in Paris now to find some of the ingredients that aren't French? Has it become easier?
What's very difficult is to find ingredients that aren't French that are organic or grown in a natural way or produced in a respectful of the environment kind of way. Finding anything in Paris, I think, is very easy. And since Paris is quite small, it doesn't take you that much time. But yeah, I think that's what's most challenging now is to find things that are okay to use for us and for our ethics, more or less.
Is there a place in the world, a market in the world that you really love? You can't wait to get there so you can kind of feed your mind?
There's a market in Bangkok I love that's called Bang Rak. Yeah, it's a bit gross, but it's full of colors. And I don't know, it just when I go there, it makes me hungry. All those vegetables and chilies and live prawns and things, yeah. People are so eager to sell everything they have, and it's so noisy, and yeah.
Very different from France.
Yeah, different from France.
Does travel for you, is it sort of part of your life menu in terms of pushing you and feeding you?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, I feel that going abroad and seeing other things makes me think a lot and helps me, yeah, find new ideas. And it really helps you breathe and see other things and see how other people work, how other people feel about what you do, how other people feel about what they do. And yeah, it's always very interesting.
It's been so lovely to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Tatiana Levha. She's the chef at Le Servant in Paris. And yes, the veal brains are still on the menu. Now we head to another restaurant that's drawing a crowd, the new Shake Shack in West Hollywood. 15 years ago, New York restaurateur Danny Meyer opened the first Shake Shack. It was a cart that sold hot dogs in Midtown Manhattan. Now it's an international chain where tourists and locals go to eat frosty concretes and gourmet burgers. Danny spoke to us from the new store on Santa Monica Boulevard. Hi there.
Hi, Evan.
So, Danny, you've got Shake Shacks in Istanbul, Tokyo, Miami, and Chicago. What took you so long to open in our city, the home of the burger?
Well, that, you know, your question is almost the answer at the same time, because I think that you got to be pretty respectful of bringing a burger to a town whose driving culture, I think, gave rise to why there are burger joints, you know, on practically every other corner of the city and up and down the entire coast of California. But you know what? It took us quite a while to learn that we could actually create the same flavor and the same culture and the same feeling west of the East Coast. It took us about 8 years before we finally opened up in Chicago about a year and a half ago. And once we did that, we opened in Chicago, we opened in Austin, Texas. And then I think a pivotal moment was opening in Las Vegas about a little bit over a year ago. And at that point we said, you know what? The Pacific time zone doesn't bite. We should do this.
Are you there right now?
I am there right now, and to the degree that you hear some sounds outside, it's because our staff is preparing any second to open the doors to the first customers who are lined up. Somebody flew overnight from the East Coast to be here.
You gotta love people when it comes to food. And I understand that we have something here in LA that other branches don't have, the roadside double burger. Could you describe it?
Well, one of the things that we try to do, Evan, whenever we go to any other city is to actually live there. We send an entire culinary team to the city for at least 6 to 8 weeks in advance. And because we're primarily, our pedigree is fine dining with restaurants like Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern and The Modern. And so our chef and chefs at Shake Shack know all the top chefs and the top places to get pastries and donuts and coffee and beer in any city. And they really, really learn. So we want to come into a new town, and about 20% of our menu tends to be customized to the best producers and also restaurateurs in that town. So, for example, one of our concretes, which is frozen custard with mix-ins, is called the Rainbow Connection. And it's our custard, but the mix-ins are spiced crumb donuts from Kofax, which we loved on Fairfax Avenue, squirrels, strawberry geranium jam. I think you probably know squirrel Jessica Coslow pretty well. And so to your earlier question, the roadside double is kind of an ode to just what we imagine people would have wanted if they had been driving their car up the coast of California a long time ago. And it's a double Swiss cheeseburger topped with onions that have been simmered in bacon and beer. And it's just absolutely yummy. A little Dijon mustard just to kick it up.
Well, I'm gonna give it some time and hope to be able to stave off the line by waiting a little bit, although that might just be a fool's errand.
You know what? Unlike you, Shake Shack is not getting better with age, so just keep coming as anytime you want to. But the other thing I want to mention, you know, people are so focused on burgers, which is great, but we're not called Burger Shack. It's Shake Shack. The frozen custard shakes are outstanding. My favorite has always been the Fair Shake, which is made with fair trade coffee. So essentially, it's probably the best coffee milkshake I think I've ever had in my life. And the other thing is that our hot dogs are really, really good. We do the Chicago-style hot dog, and we have a brand new Chicken Shack. And the chicken sandwich is so good that I have not actually missed having one. I now have a Chicken Shack and a Shack burger every time I come.
Now that I have you on the line, I would really love to ask you about some other issues. Your famous essay about tipping and how you conceive tipping and the future of restaurants practically went viral in the restaurant world and amongst people who are interested in dining aside from just what's on their plate. You talked to us in November about eliminating the tip line at the Modern, your restaurant at the Museum of Modern Art. You call it hospitality included because the service charges worked into the prices of the food on the menu. How's it working out so far?
Well, it's working out so well at the Modern. And when I say so well, I mean with respect to how our staff members feel about it, both the kitchen employees as well as the dining room members, and also our guests. They've reacted very positively, not without some bumps along the way, which I'm happy to share. But it's working out well enough that we just rolled it out at a second restaurant, Maialino. And we did commit when we launched it at the Modern back in November that it was our hope and intention to do this at all of our restaurants by the end of this year. And so far, we're right on track. It's something we believe deeply in, really for the sustainability of our industry, because the tipping culture, beyond a whole lot of cultural problems with it, which we could talk about if you wanted to, and especially in the sense that it really mitigates the professionalism that a lot of servers feel, also creates a deep economic divide between dining room members who are eligible to receive tips and kitchen members who are not eligible to receive tips, both financially as well as culturally. And it's something that we're just determined instead of sitting by, you know, closing our eyes and saying this is terrible, but it's the system, we said it's time we do something about it. And so that's what's going on right now.
another thing that's happening with your group is that you're moving Union Square Cafe in Manhattan three blocks north after you had a just huge rent raise. I'm curious to know what the difference is between opening a restaurant now in that neighborhood compared to 30 years ago.
Oh, my gosh. First of all, 30 years ago, especially if you were right off Union Square the way our original Union Square Cafe was, it was sort of a dangerous proposition because the park had not been renovated. It's true that the farmer's market, the green market, in 1985, occupied the north end of the park 2 days a week. Today it's 4 days a week. So the green market, I think, was really the first spark of activity. But it was dangerous. You know, I would come to the restaurant on a Saturday morning, and there were a bunch of nightclubs around the park. And invariably, there would be the chalk outline on the sidewalk of someone who had been shot the night before. The park was really a haven for drug dealers. That all changed. I would say that changed by about 1990 or so. A lot of advertising companies moved in. Other restaurants began to move in. Publishers began to move in the neighborhood. The green market grew from 2 to 3 and then 4 days a week, which drew tons and tons of New Yorkers to come shopping for fresh fruits and vegetables. And, you know, now, of course, what was $8 a square foot when we opened the original Union Square Cafe in 1985 would have been about $275 a square foot had we renewed our lease in that particular space. And so the neighborhood has changed dramatically. We were very, very fortunate. We spent a year and a half pulling our hair out, as you know, wondering how in the world are we going to continue to be able to call the restaurant Union Square Cafe if we can't find a space in Union Square. And I didn't especially want to open Long Island City Cafe at that point. Nice neighborhood, but it's not what I wanted to do. And we just got incredibly lucky to find a space. It's been two restaurants over the last 35 years, and the owners of the building also owned the restaurant, and they just were tired of being restaurateurs. And so what had been City Crab on 19th and Park Avenue South will now be Union Square Cafe, and I cannot wait to get it open.
I'll bet. So do you expect to bring in a different clientele in addition to the regulars who will obviously follow you anywhere?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and it's something that we're actually very excited to embrace. We're kind of viewing the second chapter of Union Square Cafe as if it were a 30-year-old startup, and by that I mean we know that the architecture is going to be different, but our goal is that if you've ever been to Union Square Cafe, there's a part of you that says, I feel like I'm coming home. And there's another part of you that feels like this is very different. And I think that's easier said than done, both architecturally, design-wise, menu-wise, staffing-wise. But the goal is that you know it's different. So you're coming back for a feeling, and we believe that that feeling can be transported. But we also want to make it fresh because we want Union Square Cafe to be for its next generation what the original one was and has been for the last three generations.
Well, I wish you luck, and I'm sure it's going to be incredibly exciting once you finally fling those doors open.
I sure hope so. You know, we've looked at the history of really classic, iconic restaurants transferring locations. And interestingly, there's good reason for your question, because a lot of them don't succeed. One that we've looked at, which has succeeded quite a bit, is Spago. As a matter of fact, I've been looking at the building that was the original Spago, because it's very close to where our Shake Shack is in West Hollywood. And that was a transformation that almost eschewed the original design. There's absolutely nothing consistent in the new spot, the second Spago in Beverly Hills, with what the first one was. And that was one way to approach it. And we're going to try to take a slightly different tack where, for example, we'll be bringing a lot of our artwork along from the original Union Square Cafe. We'll find several opportunities to, to sort of wink at people who have loved the original Union Square Cafe and yet give them something exciting to look forward to experiencing for the first time.
That was Danny Meyer, CEO of Union Square Hospitality Group and the founder of Shake Shack. The WeHo branch is open now on Santa Monica Boulevard. And now to the most important question. Since we've done this interview, can we jump the line? Kidding, just kidding. Next, we hear from a chef whose fire starter might surprise you. Steak.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app and get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. The last time we spoke with T. Georges Laguerre was in 2010, following the devastating earthquake that leveled much of his native country of Haiti. Shortly after, his Echo Park restaurant was closed for months following an electrical fire. Now he has a new memoir out called No Man is an Island that he wrote with Jeremy Rosenberg. The book charts George's journey from Haiti to L.A. and reveals a few secrets behind his tasty Haitian cuisine. Hi, George. Happy to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be here.
It must be wonderful to have the restaurant back, up and running, thriving.
You know, it's funny. I didn't realize how powerful that was, how important that was to me to own a restaurant until the day the restaurant burned down. And the following morning, I got up and I didn't have a place to go. And it was really a very sad situation.
Yeah, all of us need structure and purpose in our lives.
Oh, big time.
So let's talk about the very beginning of your life. You talk in the book about how cooking almost killed you. What do you mean?
I remember as a kid during carnival time where we would fry tower root, something, a food called akra. I was so young. There was a big pot with full of oil in there. And then I will try to make my little tiny cooking thing. And my brother Eddie came behind me and shocked me. And then that whole entire pot of oil fell off into my entire legs. So this is something that I didn't really truly describe much in the book. But it was a very bad thing for me. Thank God to my father's best friend who gave me therapy every morning. And then that's how end up being the man that I am today.
What part of Haiti are you from?
I'm from northwest part of Haiti, right across the island of Tortuga.
And what was it like growing up? Kind of describe what the outside looked like, what you did as kids.
Well, you know, growing up, it was a fun thing because I was about three blocks away from the ocean. I remember I had a dog called Booby, and then I would drag him to the ocean with me. But, you know, when you're kids, you love pets. You go around hunting, go to lakes. And then I remember my dad had a little boat. And then very young age, I would take that boat to the very deepest part of the ocean with my friends. So that's the kind of life that I grew up in Haiti.
A lot of freedom.
A lot of freedom. I remember when I landed in New York in August 1970. I will never forget that date, August 18th. August 19, my mother was going to go back to work. Since I was the oldest, she said to me, look, that door, you see that little glass? You got to see if you recognize the person before you open up the door. And there was a chain, the bar, the locks. And then the nostalgia sets in August 19, 1970.
Wow, that's powerful. How many were you? How many siblings?
We are 10, but six of us came all at once.
What neighborhood did you first stay in?
We were in Brooklyn, Eastern Parkway, and Franklin. I'll never forget that. Eating a slice of pizza was a very big thing for us. And then icing, I remember 35 cents, will definitely get your lunch back then.
When you were growing up, did any of your relatives cook for a living?
Yes, my grandmother, of course. She's the person that gave me this talent that I have. She had a restaurant.
And
a one-day restaurant.
A one-day
restaurant?
And
there was only one item in the menu, and then it took her, I'm going to say, the entire week for preparation. Because we didn't have refrigeration, she has to go to this town to buy the vegetable, the beef bone marrow somewhere else, then the preparation, 4 o'clock Sunday morning, 4 o'clock mass, because, you know, Haiti, Catholic influence. So she started preparing the soup, and then the soup will be ready by 6 a.m. Usually by 8, 9 o'clock, no more soup. The restaurant closed until the following Sunday.
What was the dish she made?
Squash soup, the one and only item in the menu. And then people would say, oh, Mrs., no more. Yeah, well, come back earlier. And the following Sunday, people will come much earlier, and people will bring their own pot. Because it's not like here in America, everything is already in a container to go. No. In Haiti, you go back then, you bring your own pot to buy whatever that you needed to buy.
So let's fast forward to when you come to L.A. Did you come knowing you were going to open a restaurant?
You know, it's a funny situation. I went to film school. The whole idea was to become a cameraman in Hollywood. So when I came to Hollywood, find out that in order for you to really make it in Hollywood, you need a parent that can support you. So my parent had so many other kids to support, I could not ask them to really support me in Hollywood. So I ended up working at a fast food restaurant, a chicken fast food. And the way they were doing it, I said, oh, no, in Haiti, we can do better. And then that's how the whole idea opening up a chicken restaurant, then I say, one day I'm going to show America how we really do it in Haiti. And that's what I did.
It's interesting because I think for a lot of people, when they think about Haitian food, they don't think of chicken right off the bat.
Well, you go to the rich house in Haiti every Sunday, I'm sure chicken is the menu with white rice and puree of red beans.
How do you make yours?
Mine, it's wood-burning rotisserie chicken. The reason why I did wood-burning rotisserie chicken, it's because I started cooking with wood in Haiti. And I wanted to do something that will truly symbolize Haiti, because in Haiti, we use a lot of wood. So I built a rotisserie in my backyard and invite everybody to taste what I was going to cook. And then it was chicken. And people say, hey, it's good. Put it on the menu, and then there you go. And that's how this whole idea of rotisserie chicken come about.
Do you use some kind of a wet or a dry rub before?
Oh, no. This is serious business. As a matter of fact, there was a guy working for me. When he saw me washing my chicken with hot water, he left. He said, in America, we don't wash our chicken that way. But in Haiti, we wash our chicken with key lime and wash it with hot water. We don't take it for granted just because it comes in a very nice box. It's clean. But we really take it to the next level. And then in my case, I marinated it in spices like garlic, bell pepper, onion, put some wine in there, parsley, and I let it marinate it for a few hours. In the past, I would let it stay overnight. But now, since the influx of business doesn't allow me to keep it that long into that, but after it's been cooked over wood-burning avocado, I will put it in a cooler, let it seal again for another day. That I observe. And then put it back in the oven for another hour and a half with the same sauce that was it was marinated and add olive oil. And then there you go. And that's what makes my chicken so succulent.
Oh, just talking about it.
Thank you.
So the avocado wood, I understand that that the avocado word, you were kind of forced into using it.
Oh, you are the first person who really truly know the true story about this. Somebody at a newspaper from downtown came by to talk to me, but I didn't know if that person was a writer. And then she said to me, "Hey, mister, what kind of you would you use?" But that day I happened to be using avocado wood and citrus. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I use avocado wood." Whoa, a week later, I was labeled wood burning rotisserie chicken on Glendale Boulevard. Then I say, since that statement have been made, so I got to go find avocado wood. And that's how I end up learning that avocado wood, California is the number one producer of avocado. And then I get it for free. And then I was able to continue doing what I'm doing now with avocado. And no one else in town does that. I'm the only guy who uses avocado wood.
If we go to T. George, and of course we're going to have the chicken, but what else should we try?
Oh, we're good on fish, red snapper, fried or steam. We're good on conch, which is a shellfish. Some people come and ask for fritters. We don't do fritters in Haiti. We saute it in garlic, onion, everything that we do. Key lime is added to it. It's probably the number one ingredient in Haitian cuisine. And then rice and beans. It's a sure thing to try it at my restaurant. And then we have akra, the fried plantain, squash soup, many things that we do there. And we have something we call legume. We do that on Saturday. That is definitely an authentic dish of Haiti. It's a combination of seafood, beef, and pork, and a puree of vegetable. It's a very long process, but if you eat that at my restaurant, that will sure definitely bring you back.
Is heat, spice, a part of Haitian cooking? Is there a condiment that's often served?
Well, I'm glad you say heat, hot. Because in America, when people use the word spicy, it's like it's a burning sensation. No. Spice, that's what gives the food flavor. I think every good cuisine has spice in them. Yes. The Haitian cuisine, we use spice for flavor, not to give you the intensity of heat where you can even eat the food. No. You shouldn't be intimidated by my cuisine because we use habanero chili, we use black pepper, but it's mild when you mix it. I'm going to say, chef, it's almost like a chemist because if you know how to mix it right, trust me, you're going to enjoy it and it's not going to be the heat spicy that people think that exists in the Haitian cuisine.
I understand that you went to Japan to cook.
Why did you know that?
Oh, I found out some secrets.
Yes.
Why? How did you end up doing that?
A friend of mine. In my case, it's always a long story. And I'm hoping that some people may think, why everything? Because Haitian, we are storytellers. There's a guy, a friend of mine, who came to America by boat. He was very lucky. He didn't have a place. Then I told him my house is welcome. But while he was sleeping, he said, "Hey, my girlfriend is teaching in Japan." I said, "Really?" So the girlfriend came up. I said, "Oh, I saw a restaurant in Japan called Haiti Cafe." I said, "Yeah, I got to go." So she put me in contact with the owner of the operation. And I invite myself. And I said, "I'm going to show you how truly Haitian cook." So that was in 2005. So I took myself to Japan and showed them how we do Haitian. And there are several Haitian restaurants in Japan that a lot of people don't know about. There were a few Japanese landed in Haiti in 47 and then fell in love with the culture. They took it back to Japan. But it's not really truly authentic Haitian. But I went there and I said, "I'm going to show you really." And I brought my own spices. I brought my own plantain, my own taro root, the beans. I basically brought a suitcase. I brought cock. I brought herring. I brought everything that will really demonstrate the truly authentic Haitian cuisine. And that's what I did.
Your memoir is marvelous. It is absolutely in your voice.
Thank you.
You're such a great storyteller. Thank you so much, T. George.
All right, a pleasure.
That's T. George Laguerre. His new memoir is No Man is an Island. T. George's Chicken is open for business in Echo Park. In a minute, our favorite food critic talks about another chef playing with fire. Stay with us.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Don't feel like chicken or a roadside double burger tonight? That's why we love Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. So, Jonathan, where are we headed this week?
We're going to Venice, to Charcoal, which is the new restaurant from Josiah Citron, who we know from his cooking at Malise. Charcoal, as you might surmise from the name, is his experiment with wood cooking, which so many people are doing right now.
And also, I'm just realizing as I'm hearing you talk, there are so many different ways people are playing with wood and grilling. So is he doing Benchaton charcoal, super hot? Is he doing live fire cooking?
There's a little bit of live fire cooking. There's a little bit of, I don't think it's Benchaton exactly, but he's thinking about the coals themselves. Like there's a dish of yellowtail sashimi that I think is laid right on the coals just for a second. Probably the biggest hit at the restaurant, maybe the opposite of what you'd expect at a place called Charcoal, but it's a whole cabbage that's tossed into the embers.
Oh, I love that idea.
Like a basketball, and it comes out and it's totally black for the first two or three leaves. And then you go in and there's this juiciness and this succulence that's really nice and really not quite what you expect from a cabbage.
So given that that cabbage must be like at the center of the table, what do you surround it with?
With the cabbage, which is, you know, neatly cleaved into bite-sized pieces, are, you know, a yogurt sauce, a little bit of sumac, the sour Middle Eastern seasoning, and lemon zest for fragrance. But mostly what you're getting is the cabbage.
That sounds really good, sumac. I like that idea.
Is sumac the new rosemary?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I was cleaning out my spice cupboard. I found four jars of it.
Wow.
So I must think that I don't have it. What else on the menu would intrigue us?
You've got the cabbage. You've got a tartare made with beef heart, maybe. I mean, beef heart tartare is another one that you're seeing in a lot of places. But it's a nice version. There's smoked lamb ribs that are brushed with a Swedish glaze. There's chicken wings. I know it sounds dumb to get chicken wings, right? You can get chicken wings everywhere.
Are they delicious chicken wings?
But they're really good. They're crisp and they're super meaty and they're brushed with herb stuff.
Who doesn't love a good chicken wing?
That's true. Get the chicken wings. There's wood-grilled oysters with seaweed and breadcrumbs, a little bit of horseradish. You pile your plates with all of the stuff. Maybe if you're lucky, there'd be some carrots. Then you start in on the meat, I guess.
Because I'm very happy having not gone to the meat yet.
It's what I'm seeing a lot of in restaurants these days is that there are so many people who are happy to base a meal around vegetables that by the time it comes to the end of the meal when you're expecting the big protein, maybe you'll get one dish for the table. The thing that I liked best was a duck that had been aged for a couple of weeks, which tightens the flesh a little bit, gives it more of a developed flavor. It's cooked in a way that leaves the skin charred and crisp that renders almost all of the fat out of it. You're experiencing it as almost like a condiment to this like beautifully seasoned meat.
What other dishes should we try?
Since it's a steakhouse, more or less, it's not a mistake to get a steak. I mean, you can get the, you know, $150 porterhouse if you're so inclined. I don't know. I just watch people eating the $150 porterhouse. There's a really great prime rib steak that has, you know, all the char and the juice and the big meat flavor that you'd expect. There's really profoundly smoked bone-in short ribs that are delicious and gigantic. And a 35-day-aged Sonoma lamb shoulder, which is finished in a almost Middle Eastern way with a little bit of coriander and a little bit of honey for sweetness.
That's the direction I would go.
That's definitely the direction you would go. I know how you eat, Evan. And with that are all the, again, the vegetable sides, which you can make into vegetable appetizers you'd want, you know, the charred carrots with ricotta or Brussels sprouts, which are charred inevitably with duck egg. And
the duck egg isn't inevitable.
The duck egg isn't inevitable, but I have seen so many duck eggs lately.
I'm sorry.
I'm okay with duck eggs as long as I can push them to the side. In fact, I've been buying duck eggs from Apricot Lane because, you know, my wife Lori loves them fried in the morning in olive oil.
They're beautiful.
They're so beautiful. The yolks are just so brilliantly colored and almost syrupy in consistency. Put them on a fettuccine, somebody's happy.
So is the experience of going to charcoal a Venetian experience in that it's pretty casual?
It's very casual. I don't think people care what you wear. My brother called me up the day before we were supposed to go there, worried that his son was going to be out of place because he never wore anything but shorts. But Zach is just fine.
Good to know. That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about charcoal Venice. Text the words good food to 69866 to get a text that will tell you where to find all of Mr. Gold's recommendations. Up next, we learn about an herb you may not recognize that's making its way onto menus in Southern California. Stay close.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. What looks like a leek but tastes like garlic? Well, let's go to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. In the early spring, we have a lot of transitional crops, and two of those are green garlic and green onions. And these are the crops that are on their way to becoming those wonderful dry bulbs we love so much. But in their stage, when they're green, they look like basically giant scallions with the long roots hanging out. And Rose Shaner with Shaner Farm is here, and she has both of these beautiful spring specialties on her table. So Rose, has the green garlic and onion become a more popular item for you?
They have, because you can use the whole green stock, chop it up. It still has, for instance, for the green garlic, it still has the garlic flavor, but it's not as spicy as the dried garlic. So you can just chop it up, put it in a salad or anything you want, use the whole thing. Nothing goes to waste unless you don't want the roots. Yeah.
So tell us how the average customer who sees these things on your table can tell them apart.
They usually can't. They ask if they're leeks first, and then some people do if they, like, smell them, because the green garlic really smells garlicky, and then green onions just kind of smell like onions.
The one thing that I noticed is that the green onion have the round, hollow tube-type tops, which looks like a scallion, and then the garlic is just basically flat.
Yeah.
These, you have these interplanted with your bulb garlic. Are you just basically thinning and these are the thinnings?
Yeah. So my brother Paul was asking my dad if we should keep getting the, pulling the green garlic out to sell as green garlic, or should we let it stay and have it bulb out? And my dad's like, let's keep picking them because it's good on the table. So it does, if we leave them in there, then it does turn to bulbs.
And as we go along, it's going to keep getting kind of bigger and fatter.
Yes, yes. People are even sometimes they're like, whoa, these things are huge. Like, are these leeks? I'm like, no, they're green onions or green garlic. They're like, wow, they look ginormous. So they already are pretty big for customers to see.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I know they're really popular this time of year. And like you said, the flavor's a little milder, mm-hmm. but they're really fun to cook with.
Yes, yeah, they are.
not to mention throwing the whole thing on a grill and just eating it like a stick of celery.
Yeah, it's good.
Okay, great. So you'll have these for about another month.
Yes.
And we'll just watch them get bigger every week.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
That was Rose Shaner, and Shaner Family Farm farms down in Valley Center, and they grow quite a bit of citrus, and then they have the wonderful green garlic, green onion, and then bulb garlic and onion later in the summer. I'm visiting with Gavin Humes, who is the executive chef at Cliff's Edge. Gavin, we love it. You're here at the market. You're shopping. You want to give us an idea of what you're looking for and what you're cooking with?
Sure. Well, right now, there's so much great stuff at the market. The stuff I'm here for today is actually green garlic. It's just coming out now. We're just starting to see the first bits of green garlic out there, and it's such a great ingredient. I love using garlic just about anywhere I can, and green garlic has a lot more complexity. It's a little more subtle, a little sweet. And it's really great. It can be used in so many different ways.
So none of that heat is there yet?
Not so much of it, yeah. For the most part, it's a very much more of the mild kind of aromatic qualities that garlic brings without so much of that kind of back-end kick.
And none of that pesky peeling.
Exactly, absolutely.
So how does that add to your dish as far as the toned-down garlic?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we're trying to do is we try to use the whole piece of everything, right, all the vegetables. And in Greek garlic, there is a little bit of cleaning. It's not all the peeling, but there is some cleaning. They've all got root ends on them, like scallions might. And we trim off all of that. We use the root end, as well as some of the trimmings, to make a stock that's a really kind of aromatic, garlicky, sweet garlic broth, basically. And we use that to infuse into a green garlic jus that we reinforce with a little bit of chicken stock, some whole grain mustard, shallots, a little bit of white wine. And we use that as a sauce on a pork belly dish. And then, in addition, we use the main part of the green garlic, as it will, and we char grill it, so it has kind of brings out some of those little bitter components that complement the sweetness of the garlic, and use that over the top of a pork tenderloin that we're serving right now.
And the only ingredient in that garlic broth is just the garlic roots?
Mm-hmm. In the garlic broth, we just use the roots, yeah. So we get a really intense, pure garlic flavor. You could add other flavors, right? You could use it certainly as a component in a stock that you are making with carrots and onions and all that kind of good stuff, and it'd be a great background note, but we really want it kind of to be front and center.
So that flavor must be very concentrated then in the roots.
It is, absolutely. We get a real strong garlic flavor, but still all the sweetness. We still don't have that heat, which is really nice. We get a more subtle kind of relaxed version of garlic that really complements the pork really well.
Mm-hmm. And then for those of us who are so happy now, all we have to do is chop a whole stem of garlic. Is that something good we can just throw in a saute pan and use it like we did the garlic clove?
Yeah, absolutely. The soft green parts of the garlic are great. You can use them like scallions, raw over the top. You can chop the whole thing, stir fry it, throw it in a fried rice, just about anything, honestly. It's a really beautiful ingredient.
Yeah, it must be nice to make enough of that stock then to kind of keep a little longer.
Absolutely. The stock is wonderful. It stores really beautifully in the refrigerator or the freezer even, and it works great. We've made risotto out of it. We've made soups out of it. We made just about anything that you want, kind of that sweet garlic flavor.
Yeah, it'd be so nice to preserve that flavor for the year. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a short season because every week that garlic's going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So you have about a month or so window, according to some of the farmers.
Yep, that's about right. But that's in keeping with what we're doing over at Cliff's Edge, right? Our menu changes fairly frequently. So when the green garlic is done, we'll move on to the next great thing that's at the market. There's always something new coming out. So
I know, that's what we love so much. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. That's so interesting and such a great time to seize the moment and go get that green garlic.
Absolutely.
That was Gavin Humes. He is the executive chef at Cliff's Edge and inspired, as we all are, about spring and this beautiful green garlic. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find a recipe for pork tenderloin with grilled green garlic jus, and asparagus on the Good Food blog. That's courtesy of Cliff's Edge in Silver Lake. Mmm. We close out today's show with a lesson on how to make cheese from David Asher. His new book, The Art of Natural Cheesemaking, has recipes and tips for how to transform simple ingredients into complex cheeses. David, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Evan.
So I have to ask you, what is natural cheesemaking? I think most of us think of cheesemaking as a very sort of natural craft.
Well, when cheesemakers make cheese in North America these days, they use more industrial approach to cheesemaking rather than a more traditional approach. And the industrial methods that are often used by cheesemakers today, whether they're at an industrial scale, an artisanal scale, or even at a home scale, make use of some ingredients that aren't as natural as they could be.
So, for example, I recently was in a, you know, beer and wine shop, and they had different cheese cultures. So I purchased a culture for making creme fraiche. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's one of the ingredients that the cheesemakers often use that comes from a often questionable source and may not be as natural as many cheesemakers might think. Traditional cheesemakers that practiced their craft didn't, of course, use these packaged freeze-dried starter cultures, but rather they cultivated their own strains of microorganisms in order to make their cheeses.
When I think about cheese and microorganisms, I guess what I usually think of is after the cheese has been separated into curds and whey and is in a form, and then it goes into a cave, and then it's like beset by all different kinds of microbial bugs that give it character. So take us through the beginning. I guess with the milk itself, I would imagine that the quality of the milk at the very beginning makes a big difference.
Oh, it's absolutely key. My cheesemaking approach is quite different from what a standard cheesemaker might practice in North America. That's usually pasteurizing their milk and adding back these freeze-dried packaged cultures that you just mentioned. For instance, for making a camembert, they'll choose a selection of different cultures. For making a blue cheese, they'll use others. For making a cheddar, they'll use another selection. Whereas when I get started, I warm up my milk as fresh as possible and add to that milk my own home-kept cheesemaking starter, which is my kefir culture.
The kefir culture ends up becoming a starter for other cheeses?
Exactly. So kefir cultures is known for making kefir, this traditional fermented beverage from Central Asia. The microbial community that's present in the kefir culture allows kefir to be used as a starter for making a broad range of different cheeses. It's more in line with a traditional approach to making cheese, in which cheesemakers would have just worked with a microbial diversity of raw milk to allow their cheeses to evolve from milk.
Doing it that way, is there a greater possibility that something wrong could happen, that a microbe from the air in one's kitchen could affect the batch in a way that you wouldn't want?
I believe that there's actually security in using more traditional methods, security against wild microbes finding their way in. The more diverse cultures, those that are present in kefir, or those that are present in raw milk, occupy all of the ecologies within milk and prevent other unwanted microbes from finding their way in. And kefir culture has been shown to limit the growth of E. coli and Salmonella and other microbes that can often find their way into cheeses that don't necessarily have as well established of a microbial ecology because they're made with individual strains of freeze-dried packaged starters, just like the ones that most cheesemakers use.
Is it difficult for most of us to find raw, and I would also imagine unhomogenized, milk?
Well, it depends on where you are. Now, down in Los Angeles, where you are, getting access to good milk is actually surprisingly easy. But in other jurisdictions, raw milk is harder to find. You may have to go directly to the farmer in order to pick it up. Where I am, up in Canada, raw milk sales are illegal. The only way to get good raw milk is to steal across the border into a neighboring state, say Washington or New York, where raw milk sales are legal, and then bring back gallons of milk across.
Let's assume we have the good milk and we have some kefir starter. What else do we need?
Well, that's it to get started. And depending on the cheese you're making, that could be all you need. But most cheeses call for the addition of an enzyme known as rennet that helps separate out the curds from the whey. And this is another ingredient in which cheesemakers aren't often using, you know, as natural an enzyme as they could be.
What is the difference between what you use and what a more industrialized cheesemaker might use?
So I use what's commonly called a calf rennet. It's a rennet that's derived from the fourth stomach of a young calf that has to be slaughtered in order for cheesemakers to gain access to this enzyme that's present on the young animal's stomach that helps the young animal transform its mother's milk into cheese. You're essentially reproducing the what happens inside of a young calf stomach when they drink their mother's milk. And this is the traditional rennet, this calf rennet, that's been used for thousands of years. It's what makes, you know, I believe, the most natural cheese, whereas the majority of cheesemakers today use alternatives to calf rennet, more often than not, they're known as microbial rennets because they're derived from microbial sources.
How do you source this calf rennet? Is it easy to get?
I get my rennet from a cheesemaking supply shop online. Companies like Glengarry Cheesemaking or New England Cheesemaking Supply Company sell rennet to the general public. It's a little bit hard to find in stores these days, but if you've got an Italian or Portuguese community in your neighborhood, they'll often have rennet in their grocery stores.
Okay, so once we're doing this, if we're going to set out on this voyage, do we want to start making the soft cheeses first?
I do recommend it. Making soft cheeses doesn't take as much involvement. They're often really delicious and really easy to make, ready to eat in just a couple of days, don't require any aging to bring about their best flavors. Harder cheeses typically take a longer time to work with, a longer time to make, are more involved of a process and take longer to develop their more interesting flavors.
So the Food and Drug Administration said it would take another look at the criteria for raw milk cheese from a food safety perspective. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's really good news for cheesemakers. We were very concerned that, you know, we would not be able to make cheeses that we currently make with raw milk anymore because of the concerns over contamination. But it looks like they've taken a step back and are eager to listen to cheesemakers who wrote in droves to the FDA in opposition to their concern.
So if we're sufficiently intrigued to open your book and start off, what would be our sort of beginner recipe?
Well, I encourage people to start off with yogurt cheese, really simple cheese. It's easy to make at home. It's made by taking yogurt, a good quality yogurt, and hanging it in cheesecloth to let it drain its way. And as the yogurt drains its way, it slowly thickens up into cheese. I encourage people to use a do-rag to make it. Do you know about a do-rag?
Yeah, sort of like fine bandanas.
That's right. Any sort of material that has a fairly fine weave that holds back the cheese but still allows the whey to flow through will work super well for cheesecloth.
Yeah, I have actually a few really large, very fine handkerchiefs that I use for cheesecloth instead of cheesecloth.
Yeah, and those will work great. I mean, you don't have to go to the store and buy cheesecloth in order to make this happen. In fact, the cheesecloth you get in the grocery store has way too open of a weave. You need to put down 4 or 5 layers of it to hold back the cheese, but then you've used up almost the entire package. And after one use, you almost can't wash it.
Well, David, it's been really a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure being here.
David Asher is the author of The Art of Natural Cheesemaking. You can find a recipe for his yogurt cheese on the Good Food blog, but you'll have to buy that do-rag all on your own. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That is Abby Fentress Swanson, Laryl Garcia, Camelia Tse, Joseph Stone, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.
I'm plagued by vegetarians.
No cats and dogs, I'm not a veterinarian.
Strictly collard greens and an occasional steak.